Dr. Kendall is the founder and president of Reasons for Faith Ministries, a nonprofit ministry dedicated to equipping Christian believers to give every man an answer for their Bible faith. He is an ordained minister at the Calvary Chapel of Weston, Texas. For over 35 years, he has engaged in traveling, teaching ministries, lecturing on biblical apologetics and scientific case for creation. Dr. Kendall's Creation Science Seminar has been repeatedly acclaimed as one of the very best in the nation. Has been enthusiastically endorsed by Dr. Dwayne T. Gish, Senior Vice President Emeritus of the Institute of Creation and Research. And so we've been very much pleased to have you here, brother, and we want to invite you here. Is it a little warm in here?
Yeah.
All right, I'll have my ushers kind of cool it off in here. All right, and I thought it was a little warm myself, so thank you. Doctor, come right on up here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pastor Mark. It's good to have you all out this evening. I'm trying to stay back a little bit more so people over here can see. I make a better door than a window. So, I do always like to start out with a little bit of humor, because a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. So you will be duly punished again. Pastor Mark was the inspiration for this one. What? Well, got to give credit where credit is due. But what was the favorite type of restaurant that Paul visited often? His favorite type of restaurant. Well, it was kind of restaurant Pastor Mark took me to today, the buffet. Didn't Paul say, I buffet my body daily? Well, didn't use the French pronunciation. Okay, maybe just a couple more. let's see. What woman in the Bible was the most successful banking entrepreneur? What woman was the most successful banker in the Bible? Well, it turns out to be Pharaoh's daughter. See, she went down to the bank of the Nile and withdrew a little profit. Okay. Hey, thank you. Okay. Just one more. what man in the Bible committed the greatest number of sins in the shortest possible amount of time? And it wasn't Samson, although he might have been a close second. Well, the man who committed the greatest number of sins in the shortest possible amount of time was Moses. He is the only man in history who broke all Ten Commandments simultaneously. Okay. Okay, enough. Enough punishment, all right. Tonight, we're going to be looking, I guess maybe I have to turn this on again. When all else fails, turn on the switch, okay. Tonight, we're going to be looking at the nanometric machines of life. And this is one of my favorite presentations. Although it is somewhat technical, it helps us to understand how fearfully and wonderfully we are made, and how fearfully and wonderfully all biological creatures have been made by our great Creator. I started believing in evolution at a very young age. My brother, 6 years older than I, was always interested in science, and he took me under his wing and got me interested in science. And I loved to go down to the library and read all these books, especially about dinosaurs. I loved biology and paleontology especially. And my brother seemed more like physics and astronomy. But I got thoroughly indoctrinated in evolution without even going to school. You know, it was in the books in the library, and you think, well, boy, you know, it's in a library, it's gotta be true. You know, it was a rude awakening much later in my life to realize that just because something's in a book and stated as a fact, it is not necessarily true. The Bible says the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one, who is the father of lies, and you should expect the world system to lie to you all the time. Bald-faced, absolute lies, even though the truth is diametrically opposed to it. They boldly lie all the time. And that's especially so when it comes to the key question of life. The ultimate Achilles heel of Darwin's theory is getting the first living species. If you can't get the first cell, the first living species, then logically it cannot evolve into all the other species. If you can't get to base one in baseball, you can't get to home plate either, can you? If you can't get to the first base, you're not going anywhere. And although in Darwin's day they thought that a living cell was very simple, it could just fall together by chance, we now know in the 21st century that the tiniest living and reproducing cell is far more complex than any machine. that man has ever dreamed of creating, much less succeeded at, in that individual machines within our living cells are measured at the nanometric scale, not millimeters, not micrometers, which is a millionth of a meter, but nanometers, which is a billionth of a meter, not even visible by normal high-powered optical microscopes. We have to use incredibly high-powered scanning electron microscopes to even see these nanomachines within our cells. So life requires two things that in the entire history of the world and in the entire history of science has never been seen to arise except by intelligent design and control. One is information, and the other is machines. Machines that are built on the basis of that blueprint information, machines programmed by that information, and machines that help to get the information out of the information storage system called DNA so it can actually be translated and used. Now, information is interesting in that in all of our scientific experience, it's not seen to be inherent in matter or energy. The evolutionist atheists claim that the materialistic universe, matter and energy is the whole of reality. There is no higher power, there is no intelligent God who transcends the physical universe. And yet, matter and energy is not information. Most important component in all living creatures is information that controls the growth, self-maintenance, self-repair, and eventual reproduction of all living creatures. Without the DNA blueprint, like a computer code somebody wrote to make the whole factory run automatically on time and keep on running and keep reproducing for thousands of years without any outside maintenance or repair. It's a masterpiece of technology that we cannot match even in the 21st century. But information is not matter and it's not energy. Where from then did it come? In all of our scientific experience, it comes from a transcendent mind and intelligence, and it's imposed on matter and energy by that outside intelligence, but it's not intrinsic in matter and energy. So they can't even explain the most important component in all living creatures. From where did information come? Now we can explain it. We can go in any laboratory, any day of the week, a scientific method, repeated experimentation, observation, proof. You get information by an intelligent author. You get machines by an intelligent inventor and engineer who conceives of it in his mind, builds the parts, puts them together, and makes it work. We have never seen it arise in any other way. So science is thoroughly on our side. Science is what you can prove by experiment is true reality. And the true reality is the two most important things in life only come by intelligent design. They have no experiments that prove otherwise. Now they claim they do, and we'll look at that briefly. But right now, here we have this marvelous cell. It is like a factory city. It has a border control system, amazing, a border wall. And only certain things are allowed in, certain things out. It vets the chemicals that go in and out. It has very complex organelles in it, and it is mind-boggling in its complexity. But there's three major components you have to have. The cell wall is composed of lipids, which are fatty acid compounds. You've heard of liposuction? Well, fats or fatty acids are what you're sucking out of your body with liposuction. But you have to have some fat. Fat are important for the membranes of cells. You also have to have proteins. That's what the main structure and catalytic reactions and the things that make things happen in the cell, the nanometric machines that make things happen in the cell, are proteins. But you also have to have the big library here in the nucleus that stores all the information that specifies how to grow, how to reproduce, how to do everything in the right order, the right place, the right time, and then to copy everything and make a virtual copy of itself and keep on doing that for thousands of years, something that none of our machines can do. Now, where did this come from? You have to have the fatty acids for the membrane, you have to have the amino acids, the building blocks for proteins, and you have to have the nucleotides, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. Well, they claim Stanley Miller, way back in 1953, well more than a half a century ago, showed us how we don't need God or intelligence to get the origin of the first living cell. That is as bald-faced a lie as you will ever hear in your life. He cheated radically. He got the most inane results that, compared to what they need, it's like making a galaxy out of a molehill, not a mountain out of a molehill. They make a galaxy out of a molehill with their claims here. All of these experiments have uniformly failed for all these decades since this landmark experiment. In fact, why do we still, on university websites and in our textbooks, have a picture of Stanley Miller here with this experiment he did more than 50 years ago? Answer, they haven't been able to do anything better, or somebody else's picture and different experiment would be up there. This is the best they have to offer, and it's an abject failure in the extreme. But most people don't know that because they say, oh, he produced a few amino acids, the building blocks of protein, so abracadabra, you get life. Not quite. That's like saying, well, the lightning hit, some clay on the bank of a river and it produced some, things that look kind of like roughly like bricks, fried them into bricks, and that explains how we got the Empire State Building. Not quite. You need a lot more than that. A lot more. So how did he cheat? For one thing, he used electrodes to simulate lightning as raw energy to cause the synthesis of bonds so that the chemicals in the ancient atmosphere, now back at this time they thought it was methane, ammonia, nitrogen, hydrogen, and water vapor, this raw energy would force the synthesis of bonds to form more complex chemical compounds, and especially things like amino acids needed for proteins. But that energy is also 10,000 to 100,000 times more effective at destroying it. So every time this would spark, it would produce a little something, but the very next spark would destroy it much more efficiently. So at the end, you don't even get a detectable trace. How did he figure that out? He said, I'll put a suction device and suck it down after every burst, so it won't be there when the next burst comes to annihilate it. Now, where in the primitive Earth do you have a scientist with his suction device to get these things out of the way of raw energy that would destroy them? You don't. It's intelligent manipulation. He also excluded the known wavelengths of ultraviolet light, which would be very destructive. When you send the full wavelengths of ultraviolet light that we know exist from the sun, it would be far, far more destructive than it could be constructive. So he excluded that, and he put in this suction device in a trap. Even at that, he couldn't get all 20 alpha amino acids required for proteins. He didn't get all the nucleotides required for DNA and RNA. He didn't get any fatty acids. There's never been any successful synthesis of fatty acids, which are required for lipids, which are required for cell membrane structure. So if you can't get the building blocks, then you can't have life. And you not only have to have them, you have to have them in adequate quantity and purity, which has never been done. He said, I got 2% amino acids, but he didn't get all 20. He got mostly the simple ones, not the complex ones. There's 20 different kinds of alpha amino acids. And if you don't get them all, it's kind of like trying to write a book when you only have a very small part of the alphabet. How are you going to do that? It doesn't work. So it really was inane. It really showed it doesn't work, that raw energy is not capable of producing all the correct compounds in the proper proportion that they're needed to and with adequate purity, because most of what he produced, he said, I got 2% amino acids, but that means 98% of it was non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds. This is supposed to be the process that produced the primitive soup on Earth that spawned the origin of the first living cell. But it wouldn't be the primordial soup. It would be suicide soup. It would be a toxic waste dump, because the vast majority of the compounds are non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds that if they got incorporated into protein or DNA molecule would destroy its function right at the get-go. They never talk about that. I always bring that up in every university debate I've ever been in. What about all the non-biological compounds? How do you extricate what you need out of that to get what you want? Oh, well, it must have happened because life exists and we know it could not have been created, so the fact that we exist proves that these seemingly impossible problems were overcome. You don't have to study much logic to realize that is a non sequitur. That is, begging the question, that is a logical fallacy. But they don't have real science, so they have to use logical fallacies, is my conclusion. Anyway, another big problem, he claimed he got 2% amino acids, but half of the amino acids that are produced are always of the wrong kind. See, raw energy can't think. It can't think, gee, I need to produce only left-handed amino acids. Those are the kind that are used in proteins. Never the opposite mirror image, which is just as probable by chance and by raw energy, right-handed amino acids. So raw energy can't think. It has no consciousness. It can't think, well, gee, I need to make proteins, and one of the requirements is exclusive purity of 100% left-handed amino acids, so I better produce only that. No, it can't think. It can't reason. It just, provides raw energy that causes these atoms to bond on the carbon molecule, and it is just as likely to bond in a left hand as in a right hand, which means you get equal amounts of both. These are useful. These are non-biological, lethal, and toxic. Furthermore, there are hundreds of possible amino acids that can be formed by raw energy. Only 20 are used in proteins exclusively. Any of the other ones, absolutely deadly if you get them incorporated. So he really only got 1%. 99% of what he got was non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds. Now then, here we face the problem. Life is very much dependent on information, and information is carried in proteins too. And those amino acids are like the alphabet letters in a sentence. They have to be put in the right order to spell out the right words, and the words have to be put in the right order to modify one another and to carry meaningful information. So here we have, this sentence is composed exclusively of the alphabet letters of the English language and makes sense in the English language convention. That's the kind of specificity we need for life. What do we get from Miller type experiments? This. Would anybody care to read this for me? Can you extract useful information out of this? No. The very thing that we need most for life, useful information that's highly specific, just ain't there. And it never is going to be there. All the experiments get the same result. How many times do you have to do the same thing over and over and expect a different result? A definition of insanity, Einstein said. They keep getting the same results. It shows it's impossible. Here and there we get a useful letter, but the most of them is a binding mass of non-biological toxic compounds, like non-biological or non-alphabetical symbols that are only going to get in the way and keep you from writing information. It's completely a lethal problem. Now, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is not life in and of itself, but it is the most important component in that it's the blueprint that carries the instructions for the growth, self-maintenance, self-repair, and reproduction of living creatures. Without somebody having written that computer program, so to speak, the machine, the great factory city, would not know what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and how to make everything run smoothly and in order. But Darwin didn't even know about DNA, you know. I mean, Watson and Crick didn't get the Nobel Prize for their discovery until the 50s. You know, they did the discovery in the 50s, 1850s. Darwin wrote his book in 1859. It wasn't discovered to the structure of DNA until the 1950s, a century later. But we know today it is incredibly specific and pure in its structure, and deviation from that purity makes it fail. It is irreducibly complex, just like our internal combustion engines. You can have all the parts there, and they all work except one. Say you have a defective fuel pump, and it doesn't work. Doesn't matter that all the other parts work. You're not going anywhere until you fix that part. Even a non-moving part, like a fuel line that's broken, not even a moving part, but if it doesn't work, the whole system is inoperative. It all has to work together, or it doesn't work at all. And in the living sense, all these components have to be there or it can't live and reproduce. And that means extinction, not evolution. Now, when we look at the structure of DNA, we have to have all exclusively left-handed deoxyribose sugars. The D in DNA stands for deoxyribose sugar. And they all have to be right-handed, instead of left-handed. Now, with the proteins, exclusively left-handed amino acids. DNA and RNA, exclusively right-handed sugars. Again, can we get that? Well, let's check it out. To get all right-handed sugars from a mixture of even amount of left and right-handed, which raw energy produces, is the same probability as flipping a penny and getting a head or a tail. 50% probability, one out of two. Now, if you want to get 10 heads in a row, probability mathematics says you must multiply the independent probability of each step in the chain. So it's one out of two, you flip a penny, one out of two times one out of two times one out of two, you multiply them. To get 10 heads in a row is 1 in 2 to the power of 10, which is one chance out of 1,024. Not very likely. Take 10 pennies in your hand, throw them up in the air, let them tumble around, fall down. According to the laws of probability, you would have to do that more than 1,000 times on the average before you get all 10 heads. They might get a little sooner or a little later, but it averages about that, over 1,000 attempts. The evolutionists say no trouble. We've got billions of years, plenty of time to make attempts. But when you make it a little bit more difficult, it literally goes beyond the threshold of possibility very quickly. Here we have the equivalent of 1,000 heads, not a single tail, all right-handed deoxyribose sugars, not a single left-handed one. Get one in there, it destroys the molecule. It's that specific. Just like that fuel pump not being there with all those other parts, if it doesn't work, the system doesn't work. It's that specific. So now it's not 1 in 2 to the 10th power, it's 1 in 2 to the 1,000th power. 2 multiplied by itself 1,000 times. Can be converted logarithmically to this number, which is expressed instead of multiples of 2, it's multiples of 10. 10 multiplied by itself 300 times. Now, we usually convert logarithmically to a number expressed in base 10, multiples of 10, because then the exponent number immediately tells you how many zeros come after the number 1. This number 10 to the 300th power means the number 1 longhand with 300 zeros after it. That's a big number. Remember, the estimated number of atoms in the entire known universe is only about 10 to the 80th power. This is many, many, many orders of magnitude beyond that. So it's often been said, a penny for your thoughts. Well, I'll give you a box of pennies for your thoughts, okay? Say we have a box of 1,000 pennies, and we want to get them all heads, not a single tail, all in the same place without intelligent design. So we can take and throw those pennies up in the air, let them fall. If you don't get all heads, put them back in the box, throw them up again. How long would you have to do that? Well, pretty long time. 2 to the 1,000th power, which are the odds of getting to 1,000 all heads, not a single tail, is the same as 10 to the 300th power. So let's try to get this to happen by getting a lot more people to help us. How about an army of people that will replace every atom in the known universe? That's a lot of people. And we're going to allow them to make attempts at the rate of 1 quadrillion times per second. A lot faster than normal, okay? And we'll allow them to continue to do that in every atom of the universe for about 3 trillion years, which is about 10 to the 20th power seconds. Now we multiply all this together, 10 to the 80th power equal to the atoms, 10 to the 15th power attempts per second for 10 to the 20th power seconds, we can get 10 to the 115th attempts in 3 trillion years. It's a lot older than the alleged age of the universe evolution, say about 13.7 billion, so that's a lot more than that. So we have to divide that number into the total number, and when we divide it, we find we still have less than one chance in 10 to the power of 185 after all that time and effort. So this could never happen in all of space and time according to the Borelian law of chance. Emil Borel, a noted probability mathematician, he said we may be led to set at less than one chance in 10 to the 50th power the value of negligible probabilities on the cosmic scale. So he says when it gets less than 1 in 10 to the 50th, you can write it off for all practical purposes. This is way beyond that threshold of impossibility. Trillions of universes and trillions times trillions of years would not overcome this number. Now, mathematics doesn't lie. Men lie to me all the time. Politicians seem to be especially adept at it. Now, I don't say politicians lie all the time. It's just when their lips are moving, okay? So, anyway, no, not all politicians lie. There are some that are honest, but few, unfortunately. But man lies to us all the time. Mathematics doesn't lie. If you do the equation properly, it'll always tell you the truth. I don't always like what my friend mathematics tells me. You know, if I'm balancing my checkbook and it tells me I'm way overdrawn, I don't like that. But I'm not going to get mad at my friend mathematics for telling me the truth. The thing the evolutionists won't up to is that the handmaiden of science, the most important tool in all of science, mathematics, has shown us ever since we found out the complexity and specificity of life at the molecular level, it's impossible. Even with trillions of years and trillions of universes, we can't even get one correctly structured DNA molecule, much less everything else that we need. Now, if we walked into this auditorium and we saw up here on the platform 1,000 pennies all laid out in rows like this and all had heads facing up, not a single tail, and somebody said, well, look what happened. Some kids spilled some pennies in here and they just happened to land all heads up. I'd say, you're either a deliberate liar or you're just grossly ignorant of mathematics, because nobody who knows anything would say something like that. Now, that doesn't mean it can't happen. We could take that box of 1,000 pennies and give it to a 5-year-old kindergarten student and say, please take these pennies out and lay each one on the floor with a head up, not a single tail. That child with that limited intellect could do that in a matter of minutes. It would not even take an hour. Yet trillions times trillions of years and an army equal to all the atoms in the universe couldn't come close to achieving it in all that time and all that effort. So when we see certain specificity of design, we know it had to have an intelligent origin. Science can prove that works. There is no proof that it works otherwise. Now, that's just one problem. It gets worse. We also have to have all correct bonds. The nucleotides can bond 2 different ways. One is biological and works. One is wrong and will destroy the whole molecule. It's 1 in 2 to the 1,000th power, 10 to the 300th power. We also have to exclude non-biological units. Remember with Miller-type experiments, it was nearly 100 to 1. We're going to be nice and say it's only 10 to 1. So we're really giving a big concession there. And we also have to have the nucleotides in the right order. Like alphabet letters in a sentence have to be in the right order to carry information. The alphabet letters of DNA, the adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine, these chemical building blocks have to be in the right order also. They're actually put together in triplicates called codons, and that makes 64 different possible combinations. So the genetic alphabet is more complex than our 26-letter English alphabet. So the nucleotides have to be in the right order. That's 1 in 4 to the 1,000th power. We'll be nice and say it's just 1 in 2 to the 1,000th, but it still comes out to be 1 chance in 10 to the power of 1,900, which in layman's language, we would say that means there ain't no way, Jose. But in mathematics, we would say it violates the Borelian law of chance and is beyond the threshold of possibility for anywhere, space and time in this universe or trillions of other universes. Now, these are the building blocks of proteins, amino acids. There are 20 different alpha amino acids, the main ones used, hundreds of possible amino acids, but only 20 are right and work in life. It's kind of like a 20-letter alphabet, so to speak, that makes the protein language. Now, these, again, are highly specific. You have to have the right amino acids. They have to bond head to tail with the correct bonds. There are four different bonds that can take place. Only one is biological. You have to exclude the non-biological compounds, and they all have to be left-handed instead of right-handed. You multiply all that together, it again becomes impossible odds. Now, here on YouTube, you can look this up under the title of Protein Folding Problem with Ken Dill, who is an expert in protein chemistry. And in there, he is talking about just a relatively small protein, less than 100 amino acids in this regard. And he said, protein molecules are a class of machines. They do almost everything. They make you walk and talk and think. They run your immune system. They run your brain. They run your heart. They digest your food. You think these nanometric machines that you can't even see without an electron microscope are important? You bet they are. And you have more machines in the tip of your little finger than exist in all the world today. Estimated 500 billion machines in the world today. The cells in the tip of your finger have much more than that. God has made it at a miniature level. Now then, he also said proteins are machines. These are real machines. That's not a metaphor. They use energy. They spin around. They pump. They act to cause force and motion. They are real machines, yet they exist at the nanometric scale. Now, what are enzymes? Enzymes are specific proteins that catalyze or speed up crucial chemical reactions absolutely required for life processes. Their three-dimensional structure, called the tertiary structure, always has an opening called an active site, and that's designed to fit in with another chemical substrate that has the precise three-dimensional configuration to fit in. It's kind of like a lock and key, is the analogy that's often used. You have to have this chemical substrate, and the key that fits into it, you know, has to line up precisely. If it's a little bit out of tolerance, you can't unlock it. In this sense, the life processes won't work. Now, to get an average size protein that we find in a prokaryotic cell, which is a little bit not as complex as eukaryotic cells, such as we have in our bodies, but the prokaryotes were supposed to have evolved first. But average size, 300 amino acids. So to get all left-handed, one chance in 10 to the 90th power. Get all correct bonds, one chance in 10 to the 180th power. Get no wrong compounds included, one in 10 to the 300th power. That's very conservative. And to get specific sequence of the 20 alpha amino acids, 1 in 10 to the 300th power, total 1 chance in 10 to the power of 870, light years beyond the threshold of impossibility. So we cannot get these machines essential for life based on what we do know in the 21st century. Now, research led by Hamilton Smith at the J. Craig Venter Institute in Rockville reveals that the minimum viable genome consists of 387 protein coding and 43 RNA coding genes. Now, every living cell actually has more than that. They're trying to figure out the minimal amount that would actually work. And it comes out to be hundreds of genes. And they won't work unless you have hundreds of proteins cooperating with them. So we have to have hundreds upon hundreds of these things. We can't even get one. How did we get the hundreds that are required to work in this amazingly complex system known as a living cell? Here again, the analogy I was using, we have the key, which is like the chemical substrate that has to fit in precisely to the lock. And if it doesn't fit precisely, it won't unlock. In other words, life processes cannot take place. Now, enzyme expert Dr. Richard Wolfenden of the University of North Carolina showed in 1998 that a reaction absolutely essential in creating the building blocks of DNA and RNA would take 78 million years in water, which is where it would have to happen, but was speeded up 10 to the 18th power times, which is one quintillion times by an enzyme. Now, many of these life processes would happen naturally, but it would take, in some cases, thousands, some cases millions, and some cases billions of years or more. Without these machines to radically speed up how fast it happens, life processes could not happen in a timely manner, and life would be impossible without these machines. In 2003, Wolfenden found another enzyme exceeded even this vast rate of enhancement. A phosphatase, which catalyzes the hydrolysis of phosphate dianions, magnified the reaction rate by 1,000 times more than even that previous enzyme. In other words, instead of 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 21st power times, which is 1,000 quintillion times. That is, the phosphatase allows reactions vital for cell signaling and regulation, in other words, required for life, to take place in 1/100th of a second without the enzyme. The essential reaction would take 1 trillion years. I'd like to wait 1 trillion years for essential reaction you need to live. Sorry, it ain't gonna work. Now that happens to be more than 70 times even the supposed evolutionary age of the universe, which is only about supposedly 14 billion years. Now we'll take a closer look at essential molecular machines that exist in the cells of your bodies and indeed in all living cells. One is RNA polymerase. RNA means ribonucleic acid. Polymer means many building blocks joined together in polymer. And polymerase is one that puts together these building blocks. This is the machine that has several other machines in its components. Now, you don't have different colors like this in actual molecular machines, but those are there to show you how many different machines called proteins are put together to make this very complex machine. Now, this machine actually runs down the DNA molecule. It's given directions by the nucleus. We need the blueprint to be actuated for a certain nanomachine called a protein. So find the place, read the DNA molecule, find the place where that blueprint is, start at the right place, stop at the right place, get the translation, which is then sent to the protein factory, which is called a ribosome. Now, this kind of runs up and down the DNA railroad track, except it doesn't run on top of it. The DNA runs right through the middle of it, okay? So it comes into the DNA. This splits it wide open, and on one side, you have the correct sequence that tells you the order of the amino acids that are needed for the protein machine. The order, again, is incredibly important as to how it works. So it splits it, and along this side, it forms a template, and that translates it into a different language. It translates from DNA, which is a great language for storing information. Bill Gates said it's by far the best information storage system known to exist, vastly exceeding our information storage in our computers today. But God thought of it, he made it. But although it's good for storage, it's not as good for utilizing. It has to be translated into another language that's easier to translate into the third language, which is protein. So it translates it into RNA. So that RNA snippet of blueprint information goes to a place in the cell here. Now you see these little specks, little spots? Those are tiny little nanomachines called ribosomes. They have over 50 component proteins in them. They're incredibly complex, rivaling the most complex machines man has ever made. As you can see, there's a lot of them in the cytoplasm of the interior of the cell. Many of them are actually attached to the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Some seem to freely float in the thin gel within the cell. That thin gel is called cytoplasm. Anyway, here we have a stylized depiction of a ribosome as an upper lobe and a lower lobe. It has two ports of entry. One has the messenger RNA that was produced and is coming now to the protein manufacturing machine. Now here it says mRNA, that's a misprint, a mutation. It's not a member of the RNA, it's messenger, or the NRA, it's messenger RNA. Okay, so this is specifying with the RNA exactly what the order of the protein compounds, the amino acids should be. So it comes in this port, ribosome reads it here, transfer RNA molecules are bringing in the 20 different amino acids. This is making sure that they line up and agree with the blueprint, and it rejects ones that don't to make sure everything works out right. These are bonded together and come out a different port. So now you have a very long chain of amino acids called protein. But here we have what the ribosome would actually look like. Every single fold, every single nuance of three-dimensional structure has meaning and purpose. And this thing is incredibly complex. The evolutionists even admit that. Here, evolutionist R. Garrett, writing in Mechanics of the Ribosome in Nature magazine, which is the most prestigious science journal in the world, he said the ribosome, together with its accessories, is probably the most sophisticated machine ever made. All of its components are active and moving. I think he slipped up. He said ever made. He didn't say that ever evolved. See, it's hard not to use the terminology of creation when you talk about these things. They look like they were made, and indeed they were. Now, once that once that protein molecule comes out of the protein factory, the ribosome, it is chaperoned to where it needs to go. And the molecules that attach to it and chaperone it are called, appropriately, chaperone nanomachines, okay? Now, sometimes they can do minor folding if it's needed and take it where it needs to go, but most cases, the proteins are so complex, and unless they fold correctly, like a Gordian knot, in just the right three-dimensional, conformation, they can't function. And again, all those specificities have to be there or it won't form properly. So the chaperones usually take it to a big barrel-shaped machine called a chaperone-in, okay? This has many, many different protein machines in it. And it takes and puts it inside this barrel, shuts the lid, and in a fraction of a second, that machine reads an encrypted code that tells it how it's supposed to be folded. It folds it and spits it out in a fraction of a second. That is amazing. And we'll see just how amazing in just a second here. Now, again, Ken Dill, he said the protein molecule has a code, an encrypted message on it. And the question is, how to break it? How do you break that code? What is the code? Well, this specific amino acid sequence actually carries a code that says this protein with this sequence has to be folded exactly this way. There are myriads of different ways they could potentially be folded, but only one is correct for it to function with the other nanomachines of the cell. So it has to be very precise. But how do we de-encrypt, you know? It's a similar situation that we faced in World War II. The Germans had come up with what they called the Enigma machine. It was a machine that scrambled or encrypted their military information. So they could transmit it over the radio, but we couldn't understand what in the world it said. It was encrypted. There was a real message, but he had to figure out how to de-encrypt it. Well, to de-encrypt the Enigma machine code, the British, well, many countries have given up, said it's uncrackable code, we'll never break it. But the British were highly motivated, and they had some geniuses like Alan Turing, and they actually came out with what was known as the Bletchley bomb, one of the first truly real electronic computers of the 20th century. They actually had four of these. This was at Bletchley Park in England, where they operated under the code name of Ultra to try to break the German Enigma code. And with the assistance of these four big, huge electronic computers, they did finally break that code, and it was a key to the Allied victory, really. But we face not just a human code, like the German Enigma code. We face a divine code, and that's a whole lot tougher to break and takes much greater computer power and technology. So at the IBM website here, they point out, the scientific community considers protein folding one of the most significant, quote, grand challenges, a fundamental problem in science, whose solution can be advanced only by applying high-performance computing technologies, a lot more powerful computers than the old Bletchley bomb in England. Proteins control almost all cellular processes in the human body, comprising strings of amino acids that are joined like links of a chain. A protein folds into a highly complex three-dimensional shape that determines its function. Any change in the shape dramatically alters the function of a protein. And even the slightest change in the folding process can turn a desirable protein into a disease, and often a fatal disease. So the reason they're wanting to de-encrypt the code is so that a computer can scan a protein and understand from its sequence what it should look like, and if it deviates from what it should look like, it can realize, oh, there's a problem here that can be traced back to the DNA that could eventually cause genetic engineering to get rid of a lot of genetic diseases. But you have to be able to understand this encrypted code that God put there before we can ever do that. The problem is, it's such a tough code to crack that our best computers, even in the 21st century, have struggled with it. Back around the year 2000, the fastest computer that we had, they estimated would take nearly 500 years of computational time to solve this code in one protein. Nearly 500 years. The chaperonin does it in a fraction of a second. Hope that sinks in, how sophisticated the micro-machines in your cells really are. Now, as one IBM researcher had earlier noted, it's absolutely amazing the complexity of the problem and the simplicity with which the body does it every day. Well, it's not really simple. We have an incredibly complex nanometric machine called the chaperonin that was designed by God to do it, and it reads it and folds it and spits it out in a fraction of a second. To this day, we don't have a computer that can de-encrypt it that fast. Now, here we have the IBM Blue Gene supercomputer. This was one that they decided to work on and build back in the year 2000 when they realized it's going to take nearly five centuries of computation to figure out how to de-encrypt a protein. So they came up with this massive computer. A standard supercomputer today would be about as big as from the end here to where this guy is standing, but here they have row after row, bank after bank. That's all one big super-duper supercomputer. So the Blue Gene one that they came out with in 2006 was 500 times faster than the previous computers we had in 2000. That means it shrunk it down from nearly 500 years to just under 1 year. Still quite a bit of time. They're keeping improving the Blue Gene series, and they claim that someday they're going to actually catch up to what this machine God made at the beginning of creation can do. That protein goes in, it's instantly read, instantly de-encrypted, the instructions are used, and it folds that thing perfectly and spits it out in a fraction of a second. It is absolutely astounding. So as we get more and more computer power, they're estimating somewhere around the year 2020 or in the early 2020s, we might finally have a computer that can scan and read and decipher the code as fast as the chaperonin molecule in your cells does it, in other words, in a fraction of a second. So this deciphers encrypted code and correctly folds the protein in less than 1 second. Our best current supercomputers will catch up to deciphering the encrypted code within 1 second in the year, well, we're not sure, sometime in the early 2000s. But that's an awful long time from the beginning of creation, and we're using huge square cubic footage of masterful big supercomputers to do it. God does it with something so tiny you can't see it with a regular microscope. He not only does it, it also folds it, something the computer cannot do. Now here we have the Japanese Honda Asimo two-legged walking robot. And you know, this is an amazing thing. Nowadays they have situational awareness. They won't run into things like they used to. They'll recognize things like a stair. They'll walk up a stair, turn around, walk back down the stairs. They can do handsprings. They'll jump over objects that are in their way. They can even do backflips off of a table, which a lot of us would struggle with, especially when you get older and have a bad back, you know. But this is nothing new. God created two-legged running robots that have been there from the beginning of creation, and if you didn't have them in your cells, you could not exist. This two-legged running robot is the transportation system in our cells. They run on superhighway systems that spread throughout our eukaryotic cells. So it doesn't use wheeled vans like UPS. It uses literally two-legged running robots. Now, the name of this protein robot is called the kinesin molecule, coming from the root kinetic, meaning energy and motion. So it has a long body and has like two arms up here that attach to a vesicle or a big sack of proteins. So it receives instructions from the nucleus, some proteins that have been synthesized from the ribosome. They need to be encapsulated and they need to be transported to where they're needed in the cell. So you need to take it to a certain superhighway system here, take the right exit, get it where it's needed to go. Now notice this long body has two hinges. Why is that? Because this thing doesn't walk, it sprints. And it sprints faster than Usain Bolt or anybody else. This sprints usually at about 100 strides per second. Okay? So when it takes off like that, carrying a weight that's usually much more than 10 times its body weight, it goes off fast. And with these hinges, it's allowed to bend with the force instead of breaking. Like the old adage, you bend with the breeze, you won't break. Okay? That's what it's all about. So the amazing thing is that this is running in a medium thicker than water. The cytoplasm in the cell is a thin gel, but it's thicker than water. Now, have you ever tried to run underwater? Go to YouTube and look up running underwater. Very comical. These guys dive down in shallow water on the bottom of the ocean, pick up a rock to hold them down on the bottom, and then they try with all their might to sprint. And it looks like, you know, some kind of ballet of slow motion, you know. And the reason is because water is nearly 800 times denser than air is at sea level. And so you have to push nearly 800 times more mass out of the way to move. And that is not easy. But it's worse for the kinesin molecule. It is carrying a load more than 10 times its own weight, not a small. And it's moving at incredible speed. I don't know if we're getting a little glitch in our microphone here. So these guys run really, really slow. They're not carrying a very big load. They're certainly not going 100 strides a second. They're not going anywhere near as fast as they could in dry air. Now, what does that mean? If we took the kinesin molecule and we scaled it up to where it's like the size of one of our fast machines, like a NASCAR, and it weighed maybe somewhere between 1,500 to 2,000 pounds, those legs would then probably be big enough that each stride would cover a few yards. Okay? Think that's reasonable? If you're going 100 strides a second, 3 yards each, then what? You're going a long ways, aren't you? You're going 300 yards in a second, which means it would be going in excess of 600 miles per hour. I could go out to Indianapolis racetrack, and running would leave every race car in its dust. But it can also do it underwater and with something thicker than water and hauling 10 times its own weight. I think that's a lot more powerful, proportionately, than any of our transportation machines. So these run up and down these super highways. They have these little legs that walk just as easily forward, backward, carry this big sack of proteins, more than 10 times its own weight, running at 100 steps per second through something thicker than water. We have no machines, no robots that could begin to do that underwater, much less in thick gel like this. Now we've done interesting experiments. These things have situational awareness. They don't run into each other. They'll get out of the way. if we insert a roadblock so they can't go, they don't go, oh, gee, what do I do? They immediately run backwards. They can run backwards just as easily to the nearest intersection. And like a GPS that is recalculated, they know which is the most efficient of many choices to take to get that where it needs to go, just like GPS. So we have automated, seemingly some kind of cellular GPS, intelligence, artificial intelligent awareness. It's been there for thousands of years. It's more powerful proportionately than any of our robots. Yet without this invention God made, you and I could not exist. There would not be transportation of proteins in our cells. Now another machine, which is a true rotary machine, like a rotary electric motor, is the ATP synthase. This recycles ADP into ATP. What is ATP? Well, it's a wigwam, a Native American dwelling. But in this case, in biology, it stands for adenosine triphosphate, the most important energy molecule at the cellular level. And this has to recycle so much of that. In an average day, you recycle your entire body weight from ADP to ATP. These machines are so tiny that to fit in the volume of a head of a pin would take 10 to the 17th power. That's 100 quadrillion in the head of a pin. They're incredibly tiny. You have quadrillions of them within your cells. These don't run like an electric engine, which runs by electrons, flow of electrons. This runs by the flow of positrons, in other words, protons. Proton motor force spins this like a water wheel. There's a kind of a little cam in here that opens up as it spins. And every time these lobes open, a catalytic reaction bonds inorganic phosphate to make ATP. So every complete revolution, three ATP molecules are made. Now, the cell requires a complement of about a billion ATP molecules all the time. If you take cyanide, it cripples one protein in your cell, just one, cytochrome oxidase. And that one loss of that one machine makes the whole system fail and you die within minutes because it shuts down these machines that produce ATP. You see how complex things are. One machine fails and you're dead, okay? You're dead, literally dead tired because you don't have any energy in your cells. Now that requires a powerhouse to run the machines, so you have to have a powerhouse to produce energy to run the machines, but neither the powerhouse or the machine runs unless somebody already put ATP molecules there. It's there to produce it, but somebody had to put them all there to prime the pump at the beginning. The Krebs metabolic cycle requires, by the way, 8 different protein machines for it to work, and it's the last of a much larger metabolic cycle. So again, like your internal combustion machine, it either all works together or it doesn't work at all. And unless you get all these complex machines there, the system as a whole will not live, will not reproduce, and there is utter extinction. Now the bacterial flagellum, we have a rotary propulsion system. This has over 40 protein parts, can spin up to 100,000 RPM, incredibly fast and efficient. And some of them have just one and can go about 10 to 15 body lengths per second. Some have multiple ones, go faster. The fastest one has a lot. It can go 60 to 65 body lengths per second. Now, when things are very tiny, we don't measure their speed in miles per hour, but how many of their own body lengths they can go through in 1 second. For example, a cheetah running at about 65, 70 miles an hour goes through about 25 body lengths in 1 second. However, we have discovered the ultimate hot rod when it comes to single-celled flagellar motors. And does anybody know, by the way, the nickname for this famous battleship? The Mighty Mo. Yes, boy. God, don't know what happened there. The Mighty Mo. But God invented his own Mighty Mo, which is proportionately much more powerful than this ship that has tens of thousands of horsepower in its engines. God's Mighty Mo is called the MO1 Bacterium. And it has not one or two or three flagellar propellers. It has 7 that are synchronized in the sheath and have counter-rotating gears to keep them separate from getting tangled and from building up too much friction. And that rotates as one big, huge flageller with 7 of them working together, and it propels itself 100 body lengths in 1 second. Now think about that. How many of our fastest machines can actually do 100 of their body lengths per second? For example, if we have a NASCAR race car or an Indianapolis 500 race car, 15 feet long, it goes 100 of those lengths in 1 second, 1,500 feet in 1 second. How fast would it be going? Anybody know the speed of sound? Approximately 1,100 feet per second. That car would be going 400 feet per second faster than the speed of sound. It would break the sound barrier. just going 100 body lengths per second. They don't do anywhere near that. So the key to its function is having these seven flagellar propellers spinning in a counter-rotational way. It spins in one way, the surrounding gears, 24 gears, spin in the opposite direction. That keeps it from tangling and keeps it from having too much friction. So here at the architecture of a flagellar apparatus in the fast-swimming magnetotactic bacterium, magnetotactic, that means it could use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, another amazing thing that happened by chance. But in the cross-section here, with electron microscopy, we can see that design very clearly. And here's how it actually functions. We have these spinning counterclockwise, the containing gears spinning in the opposite direction, an ingenious engineering feat. I don't think blind random destructive mutations in the DNA blueprint produce this thing. But like I say, it can outcompete virtually anything that we have. Fastest submarine ever made was made by the Russians back in the early 60s, I think the K-555. It could actually do about 52 miles an hour underwater, which considering how dense water is, that's actually pretty good. They didn't do it very often because it would tend to, you know, damage things on the periscopes and things like that, could not take the speed. But if we took this, now this is about 350 feet long. If we raise this up to the same size, of course, it'd be going a lot faster at 100 body lengths per second. Let's say we make it 1/10 of this. Instead of 350 feet, it's just 35 feet. Make it that big. It goes 100 body lengths per second underwater. 35 feet times 100, 3,500 feet, it would be going in excess of Mach 3 underwater if we made it proportionally big like our machines, okay? What about this? F-22 Raptor, it goes about Mach 2.5 in the air, but it's 62 feet long. If you take this and make it 62 feet long, it goes 100 body length, 6,200 feet in 1 second, it would be going in excess of Mach 5, more than twice as fast as our jet. Well, let's try a little faster, SR-71 Blackbird. High supersonic, 3.3 Mach, okay? Once you get past Mach 5, it's called hypersonic. Past Mach 1 is called supersonic, but this is high supersonic. It's 107 feet long. If we made this 107 feet long, it went 100 body lengths per second, it would be going in excess of Mach 9, not Mach 3.3. Underwater, not in the thin atmosphere. Well, they're trying to succeed the SR-71 with a new one, the Lockheed Martin SR-72. Which is still on the drawing board. But it's supposed to use scramjets and have hypersonic speed of 6 times the speed of sound, Mach 6. It's about 100 feet long. Here again, if we made this 100 feet long or 100 feet long and it goes, you know, 100 body lengths per second, so what, 10,000 feet per second, pretty fast, it would be around Mach 9. This only goes Mach 6 in the air. So is there anything we make that can actually beat it? Well, yes and no. Saturn V moon rocket, okay? Designed to attain escape velocity from the Earth. What's that? About 7 miles per second, or a little over 25,000 miles per hour. Uses rocket engines to do that. Now, it's 363 feet long. If we made this 363 feet long, it would also go in excess of Mach 32, but not quite as fast as the Saturn V. So you think, oh, finally, we've made something that can compete. Not really. Remember, this thing through the thin atmosphere and attains its highest speed outside of the atmosphere where there's no atmospheric resistance. This can compete at that same size, going nearly as fast underwater. Tremendous power, and it's not rocket engines, it's true mechanically induced rotary motion, a rotary motor mechanism that has that kind of power. We have nothing like this in our technology. How do the evolutionists respond to this? Well, as Francis Crick said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Let's just close our minds, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. It's evil to believe in God, so we're just going to close our minds. It doesn't matter if all the evidence supports intelligent design and contradicts naturalistic evolution. Dr. Scott Todd, an immunologist at Kansas State University, said in Nature magazine, against the most prestigious science magazine in the world, he said even if all the data, not just most of it, but all of it, point to an intelligent designer, such an hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic. You see, if it doesn't happen by natural processes, it's not scientific. Yeah, but science can't disprove that God exists, and if he does exist, he is the best explanation. The experiments and the facts of chemistry, physics, and math prove that. Now, Richard Lewontin, a notable evolutionist geneticist, he really was very honest. He says, on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes. In other words, our philosophy. to create an apparatus of investigation and set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, in other words, contrary to common sense, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Well, they can't prove God doesn't exist, and the evidence sure shows that he's the best explanation, but they've made up their mind, he doesn't even get a foot in the door because we say so. But saying it doesn't make it true, and it sure doesn't make it scientific. When we look at the amazing machines that exist at the nanometric scale, without which we could not live, no living creature could live without these myriads of machines, how in the world do we explain their origin when they involve machines and information, two things that never arise by chance, and this represents a level of technology and power that we cannot match even in the 21st century. So, as God himself says in Romans 1:20, for ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made, his handiworks. Tonight we looked at his tiniest handiworks, nanometric machines of life. So men are without excuse altogether, without any defense or justification. Now, on the judgment day, Charles Darwin will probably get a little... He can say, I didn't know about these nanometric machines, DNA, RNA, ribosomes, proteins, the DMO bacterium. I didn't know about all that. Well, he knew plenty that he did reject, that he'll be held accountable. But what will the scientists today say? Oh, we didn't know anything? We didn't know? We didn't make the discoveries? We didn't do the math? We didn't know anything? The Bible says, to whom much is given, of the same shall much be required. And they that have the greater knowledge will be beaten with many stripes, whereas those who sin more in ignorance will have a lesser punishment. What are the scientists today going to say? Darwin's excuse will not work. Many people say, well, your own Bible says your God is invisible, he's a spirit. I don't have to believe anything I can't see. I say, really? Do you believe in gravity? Show it to me. Do you believe in magnetic fields? Show them to me. Believe in radio waves? Television microwaves? Show them to me. Well, I can't show them to you, they're invisible, but I can see what they do. Touche. We can see what God has done. We can see the cause and effect relationship. That's how we know all kinds of invisible things are real, because we see their effects. God says the effects are indelible and without excuse if they're not accepted. Many people say, if God would come down and just do a miracle in front of me, I'd believe in him. God is here saying, open your eyes. Every living creature is a miracle. Now, how do we define a miracle? It has to be supernatural, something that can't happen by natural laws of chemistry, physics, and time and chance. But it also has to be superhuman, not something that a human could do. Life meets that definition. It is supernatural, beyond what natural laws, chemistry, physics, and chance can do. It's also superhuman because we can't do it today. We can't start from scratch and put together a single living reproducing cell, period. We do not have the technology. It is supernatural. It is superhuman. They are all miracles. And God says his hand to show that he exists. We are without excuse. We ignore it at our peril. Well, I've taken too long. I appreciate your patience. I do have this available on DVD, along with more than 30 other DVDs that cover just about everything in the whole creation versus evolution spectrum of evidences and arguments. So I hope you'll take advantage of that. Pastor Mark, we'll invite you up. Thank you again.
You have to buy this because you can't keep up with them. It's pretty, but doesn't it just thrill you to know that you are wonderfully and fearfully made? And I really want to speak to you, young people. I just want to tell you I'm sorry that we don't talk about this more, because you're bombarded with it. You go to school, you go to our public schools, and they've been trying to get God out since 63, by the way. They took prayer out. They don't want any God in there. And then they make up a lie. I'm sorry to tell you that. And once we step out like that, we go down a slippery slope of no purpose, no hope, unlike what God has designed for us. And many people, it says today, that come to Christ, finally agree that they're created. That is the number one thing that you must come to grips with, is are you created? And today, are you willing to accept that? Are you willing to accept that you are wonderfully made? And if so, Many, many young people today, once they step over that, they run to Jesus. Because if I am fearfully, wonderfully made, then I'm made for something and someone. Yes. And we are designed to worship. And you'll either worship God or you worship you. And I want to ask you, what are you worshiping tonight? What's your life show? Do you need to surrender and come to Christ and flee to your Creator who's got a plan for you that's glorious? Whatever it might be, God will do that for you. Tommy, come on up here. If you'd stand with me, we're going to sing a hymn or sing a song. I think we're going to probably sing.